In these bleak days, humanity is at a breaking point. Economies are tanking, the woke mob is canceling everything, and the little guy, who's just trying to run a small business, is getting screwed from both ends. But not all is lost. Amidst the chaos, two men offer up their voices in the darkness, dropping 2,000-pound laser-guided truth bombs on today's lunacy. Introducing the Sirens of Sanity, David Pridham and L. Bradley Sheaf.
Well, there it is, Brad. We didn't start the fire. Billy Joel, who, by the way, is now off the tour. He's got some condition, but hopefully he'll be back soon. And today we're going to talk to an expert, Brad, in the field of JFK assassination research and review, who also, I believe, was in the Air Force, served with you a while back, and maybe the Mexican-American War or sometime. Again, something, yeah. Much older than I am, so I don't know. But in any event, very exciting stuff, and I can't wait to get to it.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it as well. And while I don't believe that Mr. Young started the fire, he's certainly stoking it with his new book. And so let's see what he has to say.
David Pridham and Brad Sheaf back here with you on the iHeartRadio podcast network. Today we have a guest. As you know, Brad and I are delving into the JFK conspiracy and the death of President Kennedy, and we have vowed to solve this thing before Brad leaves for Central America next week. Right, Brad?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Or at least explore it to some extent. Right. Yeah. Either way. Yeah. And so, in that regard, we've got John Young joining us here today. John is a renowned author and podcaster on the subject of all things JFK. His book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy, is a great read. We highly recommend it. In addition, he has a weekly podcast, which I have started listening to in the past few months, on the JFK assassination. Both are very approachable and allow for folks who are just getting into it to understand what's going on, both, you know, what's gone on historically regarding JFK and what is happening today, because there's a lot happening today with the Trump administration and releasing some of these files. So, John, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit about your background? You're from Texas. Our company is based in Dallas. So we've been connected to Texas for almost 20 years now. But could you tell us a little bit about your background and your story?
I'm actually from Fort Smith, Arkansas. I've spent a lot of time in Dallas, so it's kind of my second home. But I'm actually born and raised in a little town outside of Fort Smith called Alma, Arkansas. And I've been studying the assassination, researching for going on 36 years now. To be honest, I got involved, as strange as it sounds. My grandfather, when I was young, used to talk to me about President Kennedy. And I started in middle school. It literally started with a book report. You know, back then we did book reports. I don't know if the kids do that nowadays. But, you know, I did a book report on the assassination. And I was assigned this book report. And I was fascinated. I started digging through encyclopedias, you know. Back then, that's what we did as a reference. We didn't have the internet. And so just started digging through encyclopedias, reading everything I could get my hands on for this book report. And it literally started that way. And I got mesmerized and just fascinated with the assassination. And I tell people all the time, as a, you know, sixth, seventh grader, while some of my friends were carrying around comic books and stuff like that, I was carrying around, you know, copies of 6 Seconds in Dallas by Josiah Thompson and other books on the assassination. And, you know, kids thought I was kind of weird. And so I just become obsessed with it at an early age and stayed that way through. I joined the Air Force in 1987. I was stationed in Wichita Falls, Texas. I was still mesmerized with the assassination, studying it, you know, every free moment I got. And one of my heroes in the research community was Penn Jones Jr. I had a weekend leave, and like I said, I was stationed in Wichita Falls. I had a weekend leave, and I said to myself, I'm going to go track Ben Jones Jr. down. It's kind of gutsy on my part, but I take off driving to Wachahatchee, Texas. He lived actually in Boyce, Texas, on a little farm, which is about 4 miles east of Wachahatchee. And so I go into Wachahatchee, stop at a little store, honestly. And I'm like, these people are going to think I'm crazy. But I go in and I say, does any of you happen to know where Penn Jones Jr. live? And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, he lives down on the farm. We see him all the time. You know, one older gentleman actually drew me a little map on a piece of paper and told me how to get to his farm. So lo and behold, here I am. I mean, I am still wet behind the ears, 20 years old. I drive to Penn Jones Jr.'s farm in Boyce, Texas, and I can still remember pulling up the driveway. My knees were knocking because I was a nervous wreck. This was a hero of mine for years. I thought, you know, I don't know if I'm going to pull up here and he's going to pull out a shotgun and shoot me. What, you know, what's going to happen? But I knocked on the door. He come to the door. His wife, Elaine, was there. But he knocked on the door. I introduced myself. And I'm telling you, that moment started a friendship that would last until he died, you know, in 97. And he took me in that day, and I spent 4 or 5 hours with him at his ranch. And he just, I mean, he opened up his research material, was showing me. I mean, he was going a million miles an hour. His house was like a shrine to the late President Kennedy. He even had a replica rocking chair of Kennedy in his office, and pictures of Kennedy everywhere, videotapes. You know, back then, everybody had the VHS videotapes, just wall-to-wall videotapes, documents, everything. It was a massive amount of research material that he'd accumulated over, you know, 35 years since the assassination happened. And that day really started my researching journey, because over the next 8-9 years up until Penn passed away, you know, he become more than a mentor. He become a really good friend. And I looked at him sort of as a grandfather figure. He actually reminded me a lot of my grandfather, dressed like him and kind of looked like him. And so my grandfather was someone that I just adored and only got to be with him a short 9 years before he passed. But so that's really started my research journey. And Penn opened doors for me that I could not have opened myself, with witnesses, with other researchers. I actually, in the early 90s, I got to meet Jim Mars, Jack White, Robert Groden, Larry Harris, some very well-known researchers that I admired, and actually joined a research group out of Dallas that Jim had put together. I didn't even know one existed, but Jim had put together this little research group. We kind of met in secret, so to speak. And so, you know, we would meet on weekends, and I got to interview dozens and dozens of witnesses, got to interview Secret Service agents, got to sit down and have dinner with Marina Oswald one night at her home. And that just really opened doors for me that, like I said, I wouldn't have been able to open myself. And Penn really started that for me. And I dedicate my book, in the front of my book, there's a dedication to Penn Jones Jr. because he's the one that really started, kind of kept that fire burning in me and pushed me to open doors and you know, go out on a limb sometimes and go with my gut and go with my heart and don't take no for an answer. And so anyway, I really owe a tremendous amount to him. And just over the years, Penn passed away in 97, and I was there right before he died. And I just remember the last thing he said to me was, you know, don't let them stop your research. Don't let them, you know, slow you down. Just keep that fire burning inside you to find out what happened. And he gave me, I know, most of his research materials at Baylor University, and they've got it. It's all online now. You can find it. But I've got some very, very valuable things to me that he gave me over the years, all kinds of handwritten notes and some research material and obviously copies of his book, his signed book. And so things that I cherish.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's a great background. That's 30 plus years of yeah. research. So you had dinner with Marina Oswald. What was her story? I know early on she was, one of the people that helped seal Oswald's fate in the mind of some in terms of his guilt, but was she, what was she like to have dinner with? What did she say about the assassination and his guilt? And generally, what was her perspective on the assassination?
At the time I met with her and had dinner, and honestly, Jim Mars arranged it. And so there were several of us researchers there. Her husband, Kenneth Porter, was there. And so at the time we had dinner with her, she had totally flipped from what, you know, she'd said early on. Now, keep in mind, and a lot of people don't know this, right after the assassination, they literally took her and I wouldn't say held her hostage, but they put her up in the Six Flags Inn, which was a motel right across the streets from Six Flags Theme Park.
And well, that's the Six Flags of Texas, Brad. You know that.
Yeah. And she was literally held up there with Secret Service agents, FBI, CIA for a week, and just questions, berated. They threatened her with deportation back to Russia. So she basically said what they wanted her to say. And, you know, when she was ready to say what they wanted her to say, they pranced her out in front of the cameras, and she basically went on national television and said, yeah, that my husband was guilty and all this. But at the time I'd met with her and had dinner with her, that script had totally flipped. And she proclaimed his innocence. She even denied the backyard photos, you know, the famous backyard photos that really mm-hmm. convicted Lee Oswald in the minds of the American public, that, you know, the backyard photos were published on the cover of Life magazine. And that really convicted him in a lot of people's minds. But, you know, she told us, and she told many other researchers this too, that day when she took the photos of him standing in the alley. Okay. And the photos you see are him standing at kind of the bottom of the stairwell, or kind of beside the stairwell. And she said that is totally not where the pictures were taken. She said they were taken in front of a little fence leading into the alley. And that house on Neely Street in Dallas is still there. And I've been there many, many times. And I actually did a video call with her one time while I was there, and was saying, okay, this is where you say the photos are? Yes, this is where the photos were taken. And she said, I took one photo, not numerous photos. I took one of him standing in a totally different spot than the backyard photos that, you know, came out and got published. So she even denied that, but she,
you know, that's interesting. The photos, because one of the things I did in explaining this to Brad, because Brad came to town, a while back, and we sat down and watched the new Oliver Stone. It's not new anymore, but the Oliver Stone documentary he put out.
Revisited.
Brad was just like, I can't believe any of the, you know, this happened. And it's like, there are so many, it's the one thing, right, the JFK assassination in the history of this country, where there are so many threads that are loose, that if you start pulling on them, right, like, for example, the photos. I found out a couple of weeks ago from a friend that there was a in the Dallas police custody, they found some cutout of the photo, and then there was a Dallas policeman who may have posed. Yes. It's the craziest thing, and it is all over the place in this JFK thing, from the grassy knoll to the forensics to the, you know, the woman on the stairs to the autopsy to the, I mean, you can come up with, you know, how many crazy deaths are associated with witnesses and folks who are somehow involved in this thing. It's just, you know, when Brad and I started talking about it, when you get 2 hours into it, and there are still a bunch of things we didn't even get to. So let me ask you this: if I were someone who was a skeptic but didn't know much about it, and, you know, you had to make three points as to why this was a conspiracy, or why Oswald didn't do it, or just the three most salient points that could potentially sway someone who may be a doubter but doesn't know much about the assassination. What three points, because you've got this terrific background with this assassination, what three points would you lean on?
Number one, I would look at what the witnesses say, all right? Look at where the witnesses placed Lee Harvey Oswald at the time of the shooting. Okay. Don't go off of what the Warren report says. Dig into it. It's really readily available now. There are numerous witnesses that put him on the first or second floor in the lunchroom at as late as 12:25. All right. And then there's other witnesses that put him in the lunchroom buying a Coke 90 seconds after the assassination. Okay. And you'd say, well, you know, it's not that hard to get up five flights of stairs in 3 or 4 minutes. One thing you got to understand, and I tell people this all the time, Kennedy's motorcade was set to arrive in Dealey Plaza at 12:25. His schedule was published. It was in the newspapers, and they were set to arrive into the plaza at 12:25. That's when everybody thought Kennedy's motorcade was going to arrive in that area. It was late because he took a little extra time at Love Field to shake hands and greet the well-wishers and stuff like that. So the motorcade was running about 5 minutes behind, and that's a huge deal. Keep in mind, there were witnesses, numerous witnesses, that saw two people in the sixth floor window, in various windows in the sixth floor, from 12:15 up until the assassination. All right. Lee Harvey Oswald was, we know 100% by witness statements, in the lunchroom area as late as 12:25. Okay. If I'm Lee Harvey Oswald and I'm planning to shoot John F. Kennedy, I am in that window at 12:25 for sure, because that's the moment I thought the motorcade was coming through. Okay. I'm set. I'm positioned. I'm ready to go. All right. He was in the lunchroom eating his lunch, drinking a Coke. There were witnesses that put other people in that window. Several witnesses saw a heavy set man in a brown coat. He's mentioned a lot by several witnesses with horn rim glasses. And he was seen in the window. There was several people that saw two people in the window leading up to the assassination. I'm talking minutes before the assassination. So the Warren report wants us to believe that Lee Harvey Oswald at 12:26 went up five flights of stairs across a crowded room. That back when that happened, the sixth floor was covered in boxes. It was a warehouse for school books. It was a maze up there. It would take you a good 30, 45 seconds to get from one side of the room to the other. And the stairwell was on the opposite side of the room as the southeast corner where the shooting occurred. And they want us to believe that he jotted up there, five flights of stairs, calm, cool, and collective, three shots at the president, and wiped the gun clean of fingerprints. Because the prints were not found, except for a mysterious palm print, and I can talk about that too. And then hid the gun, went back down the stairs 90 seconds after the shooting. And by the way, he went back down those stairs past several women who did not see him, did not hear him, and was cool, calm, and collective back in the lunchroom.
That was Victoria Adams, right? Because
Victoria Adams
saw that.
And Sandra Stiles. And Officer Marion Baker rushed in the depository 90 seconds after the shooting. It's been studied and recreated. 90 seconds after the shooting, Officer Marion Baker encounters Oswald in the lunchroom, drinking a Coke, calm, cool, collective, not out of breath, not sweating, and he was with Roy Truly, who was a superintendent of the depository. So it just, to me, look at some of the witness statements and where Oswald was before the shooting, leading up to the shooting, and then moments after the shooting, all right? And then his actions after the shooting. What does he do? I mean, this is the supposed assassin of the president, all right? Does he escape in a mad rush? No. He walks out the front door calmly, seen by numerous witnesses, and goes and catches a bus. He first tries to flag down a cab. And get this. He flags down a cab. The cab pulls up. And a woman comes up, a pregnant woman comes up, and I've spoken to her, and he gives his cab up to her. This is a true story. He gives his cab up to this lady. I mean, this is the, accused assassin of the president trying to escape the area, and he gives his cab up to a woman. I mean, come on, right? And so he ends up catching a bus. The bus that he hops on is heading right back into Dealey Plaza. The bus gets caught up in all kinds of traffic. He jumps off the bus and then goes to the Greyhound bus station and tries to catch another cab. And he eventually does, and it takes him to his rooming house. And so that would be one thing. I would look at where he was moments before the shooting and moments after the shooting, and I would say that's one thing that proves his innocence. If you really dig into it and study it, that alone proves his innocence. Number two, I would look at witness statements and what they saw and heard around the grassy knoll area. I've become very, very good friends, very close with Ed Hoffman and his wife, Rosie. And I don't know if a lot of your listeners know who Ed Hoffman was, but Ed was a deaf mute, and he witnessed the assassination. And he had pulled his car. He had actually left work, was on his way to a dentist appointment, and he pulled his car off the side of Stemmons Freeway. He didn't want to get caught up in traffic, but he just wanted to get a glimpse of the president as he kind of drove by. He knew the route. He knew that Kennedy was going to be hopping on Stemmons Freeway. So he pulled his car off the side of the Stemmons Freeway there. But where he was standing, he had a clear view of the picket fence area where a lot of people claim shots came from. A lot of people. And Ed's been on many documentaries. Ed said he saw a shooter behind the picket fence. He saw two men. One was dressed in like a railroad outfit. The other was dressed as like a police officer. He saw two men behind the picket fence. One of them fired a shot. All right. Now, keep in mind, he was a deaf mute, so he had a hard time communicating with people. All right. He saw the shooting. He saw one guy shoot, toss the rifle to another guy. The guy in the police uniform, or what he described was a police uniform, fired shots, tossed the rifle to the other gentleman who was a railroad worker. He broke the gun down, put it in a bag, and just walked away. And they walked off in different directions. All right. Numerous witnesses, moments after the shooting, and there's all kinds of pictures, videos, rushed that grassy knoll area, okay? And many of them were being chewed away and told to get out of the area by Secret Service agents, people that were flashing Secret Service credentials on the grassy knoll. And this is readily available. Anybody can look this up. But guess what? There were no Secret Service agents at that time on the grassy knoll or even in Dealey Plaza. They were all with the motorcade.
That's in the Warren report, right? That fact.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, who were these people? I mean, who were these people impersonating Secret Service agents? And why were they so? I mean, Dallas police officers ran into some of these guys that produced Secret Service credentials and told them to get out of that area. They did not want anyone in that area behind the picket fence along the grassy knoll.
Well, you know what I think is interesting, and Brad, this is right up your neck of the woods, but. So Ed Hoffman, I saw him on the documentary, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and he is, there are folks who raise issues with his story.
Sure.
You also have, there was a documentary where they had some of the railroad men, and I forget, maybe the guy who did Last Second in Dallas who filmed them, but...
Josiah Thompson.
Josiah Thompson, where the railroad men are talking about what they saw behind the fence, and then they found cigarette butts, and they saw a puff of smoke, and then the guy who was working in the railroad yard, who I don't remember his name, but
Lee Bowers.
He testified in front of the Warren Commission, and he testified that there was a lot of strange stuff happening right around that fence too. So it's not just Hoffman, and then Bowers, I think, died in he's one of the many people that died in some like one car accident in the middle of a country road in Texas.
Oh, Penn Jones Jr. was, Penn really got off on the mysterious deaths, and he dug deep into that. And Lee Bowers was one of the first ones that he really dove into. But,
I made a list. So Brad, you're going to love this. So this is just a partial list of, these strange deaths. Like you've got, Grant Stockdale, who's a friend of JFK, who throws himself out of a window a couple days after the assassination, Gary Underhill, Brad, who we've talked about before, Mary Pinchot Myers, the lover of JFK, was killed in Rock Creek Park in DC, Winston Scott, the CIA station chief, Dorothy Kilgowan, who was on To Tell the Truth, right, who was investigating this thing. She was a famous journalist. David Ferry was the guy played by Joe Pesci in the JFK thing. Roger Craig, who was a sheriff. And then William Bruce Pritzker, who was connected to the autopsy. I mean, and I want to get Brad's take on this, too, because these are all people who, like, in the 60s, most cases in the early 60s, contemporaneous with this assassination or the subsequent investigations, killed themselves or died in very mysterious ways. And that doesn't even mention that it's George de Morenschild, who was being set up to be interviewed by the House Committee in the 70s. And the guy was like knocking on the door, and they found him dead. So, you know, at some point, and Brad, we want to get your thoughts on this. I mean, there are a lot of strange deaths here.
Well, John, to kind of go back to the opening of the show where David was introducing us, you've got kind of both sides of the JFK coin here. You know, just kind of generally in America, right? So David is an enthusiast. He likes this stuff. He's into it. And I was sort of like just the average American of my age, right? So Dave and I are both in our mid-50s. So obviously I'm very aware of the JFK.
Well, you're a little, to be honest, and we want to tell John the truth, you're a bit older than me. Doesn't matter how many you're
well, that's true. David looks older, but I am older. And so they... So, you know, I mean, I'm obviously aware of the assassination. I'm aware that there's, you know, all of this sort of mystery around it, but never paid any attention to it until David was kind of introducing me to it, right? So as for me, and it's fascinating to listen to you guys talk about it and all of the, you know, just kind of unexplainable amount of weirdness, for lack of a better term, that is around this assassination. And, you know, so as David mentioned, my background, I was in the military, then I was an FBI agent, and then I got out of the government. Dave and I met and we went into business together. But for me, there's just one kind of part of the story, I guess, or supposed fact that just doesn't work. And that is the quote unquote magic bullet. And so we can come back to that. But I guess what I want to, having listened to all of this, is the theory then that Oswald is uninvolved in the assassination entirely other than as a patsy, right? So Oswald is never on the sixth floor. It's someone else entirely. And, you know, they take the shots from the sixth floor. And then there's, you know, some other member of the conspiracy that's behind the picket fence. And they take at least one shot from there. That's kind of your view of it, is that, you know, so it's not like Oswald was either, obviously, you don't believe that he was the only shooter, but he wasn't even one of the shooters. He's just kind of hanging around the book depository doing his job on the day that JFK is killed and kind of oblivious to what's going on around him, and that it's others who are doing all of the shooting.
You know, that's one of the things that haunted me for years. Is what was his role? And I'm going to be honest with you. After 36 years of research, I'm not sure what his role was that day. He had a role to play. Now, some researchers believe he was one of the shooters. Some researchers believe he was possibly there to prevent the assassination. He had a role to play that day. I don't know what his role was. And I've been on both sides of the fence with this, as far as I have never thought after all the witnesses I've spoken with, looked them in the eye. You know, these are not people that I was paying money to sit down and you know, give me their story. None of these people, you know, got rich off of sitting down and talking to a lot of us researchers. But looking them in the eye, meeting them, shaking their hand, being in their homes. After all that, I do not believe that Lee Harvey Oswald fired a shot that day. But I do not, even to this day, I do not know what his role was.
Well, yeah, it doesn't sound like he could have been, based on what you were talking about before with this stairwell and kind of where he was before and after, that he could have been on the sixth floor. And that's fine. I mean, again, I'm not in any way, shape, or form an expert. I'm just kind of learning as we go along here. But in order for him not to have been on the sixth floor, I mean, I don't think there's any debate that somebody was, right? Shots were fired that floor, right? Okay, so how does that person get in and out of the depository without somebody who works there? You know, especially if it was kind of the rabbit warren, as you describe it, seeing them and there being at least one witness who says, well, yeah, I don't know who this guy was, but there was somebody that we don't recognize or that, you know, we hadn't seen before in the building today. And, you know, we saw him at this point or that point. So, I mean, whoever this person was, who is the sixth floor shooter, somehow gets in and out of that building unobserved, right? I mean, is that kind of the theory?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and no, you know, it's a good point. There's not been anyone that has come out that we know of that has said, yeah, there was a strange gentleman, you know, in the building.
Hey, John, real quick, wouldn't they have to get down the same stairs, though? So all the people that we're talking about that Oswald didn't pass, whoever this was, would have to go down that same. There's only one way up and down, right? Or the elevator, but
yes, yeah, they would have to go down the same stairs. But there are witnesses that place the heavyset man that I talked about earlier in the brown coat. There are some witnesses that say they saw him still in the window as late as 30 seconds after the shooting. Right, kind of looking out the window as to, you know, admire what had just happened. So where did that gentleman go? I don't know who that gentleman was. I don't know.
Was there a moment? So Marion Baker, the police officer,
right,
was in the saw Oswald drinking the Coke within like what was that a couple minutes of the assassination?
Or 90 seconds after the
90 seconds, and then he goes to the stairs and goes up the stairs. So and then did he from that point was the building secure or were there points where there were lapses in?
Oh no, the building wasn't secured until at least 15 minutes after the assassination, and it may be longer. Reports say 12:45, but I've spoken to witnesses that say they were in and out of that building as late as 1 o'clock. So
did Baker leave the building after he I guess he went ascended and then
they actually were heading to the roof. Baker thought shots came from the roof, and so Baker and Roy Truly. And the elevator was not working that day, by the way. They had an old grain elevator in the depository. The elevator was not working that day. It was down, so it wasn't working that day. So that's why, you know, the stairs come into play to get up and down those floors. There was one stairwell. And so Officer Baker and Roy Truly, the superintendent, they were actually making their way to the roof because that's where Baker thought shots came from. He saw pigeons. When the shots fired, he saw pigeons fly off the roof that caught his attention. So he immediately, I mean, Baker immediately, you know, threw down his motorcycle and went into the book depository. And they come up to Roy Truly, who was the superintendent of the building. And, you know, they start going floor to floor and they're, you know, they're searching for, you know, floor by floor, making their way to the roof. And they did. They actually got up there and searched the roof area. But so, yeah, it's where did the guy go that was the shooter? I don't know. Nobody knows. If they know, they're sure not talking.
Did there have to be a shooter from the building?
The ballistics that I've studied, there had to be at least one shot from there. Now, I believe there were shots from the Dowtex building and possibly shots from the Dallas County Records building. A little known fact that a lot of people don't believe is there was a spent 30-aught shell found on the top of the county records building, and I forget the year. I want to say, and this is easily looked up, 76 or 77. There was a air conditioned worker up there working on an air condition because it was leaking, and he found an old bullet casing underneath the lip of this air conditioner on top of the Dallas County Records building, which is a place where I believe at least one of the shots came from, looking at the trajectories. So, and that's a little known fact that a lot of people don't believe, but you can easily look it up. So was there a shooter up there? I mean, there were numerous witnesses that placed, you know, a shooter on the grassy knoll. This thing is like a giant puzzle. It's like a giant puzzle. And Penn always told me, you know, he said, imagine getting a 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzle and throwing it on the table. That's what this assassination is.
With no corner pieces. There are no corner pieces.
And it's just like, but if you start putting pieces together, all right, things start making sense. It's like Lee Bowers that you mentioned. Him and Ed Hoffman's story matches up perfectly. They did not know each other. They had no idea what the other one was saying. And by the way, Ed went to the FBI office in Dallas right after the shooting and tried to tell the FBI what he saw, what he had just witnessed. They had a hard time communicating with him because he's deaf, and honestly, they didn't have anyone there who knew sign, so they just basically told him to get lost, and this is documented also. He went back the following Monday, the 25th. He went back to that same FBI office trying to tell his story once again, and they basically ignored him. But his story and other witness testimonies match up. His story matches up with Lee Bowers. Like I said, it's a puzzle. You start putting little pieces together, and you can't solve the whole thing in 2 weeks, guys. Sorry.
But, well, he's leaving in a couple days.
Yeah,
so
but when you start putting pieces together, things start making sense. You know, I've been on a journey recently that I never dreamed I would go on, and it was the two Oswald theory. For years, research friends of mine, Jim Mars, Jack White, Robert Groden, I mean, Penn, and others, from very early on, believed that there was a second Oswald in and around Dallas leading up to the assassination. And I'm going to be honest, they would talk about it, and I would kind of tune them out because I thought it was crazy, and I thought it sounded, you know, conspiracy nuts, and, you know. And one of the things Penn told me, he said, someday I want you to really dive into this, and I want you to research this, and you will see what we're saying is true. So I took time several years ago and just put all my other research aside, and I said, I'm going to dive into this second Oswald theory.
And I don't mean to interrupt you, John, but isn't this the one of the things Brad and I have talked about before is that whole Ralph Leon Yates thing where he picked up a hitchhiker and the guy looked just like Oswald, and he went back and he actually told one of his co-workers the story before the assassination took place of a guy with curtain rods and all this craziness. And then tell me if I'm wrong, but then the assassination took place and it looked just like the guy he had picked up, but it couldn't have been Oswald because he was working at the time.
Oh, and listen, guys, there are so many. I started investigating this, and there's documented proof of a lot of these things that I'm saying. There were so many sightings of Oswald. Oswald had been meeting with the Texas Employment Commission. He met with them several times. And he was interviewed by a lady there named Laura Cottrell three different times. So she had spent 3 to 4 hours with Lee Oswald. One day, October 17th, when Oswald was working at the Texas School Book Depository, we know this from his time card and his coworkers, a gentleman came to the Texas Employment Commission who Miss Cottrell said looked strikingly, credibly resembling Oswald. And he tried to tell her that he was Lee Harvey Oswald, but she knew he was not. She had met with Lee Oswald numerous times, but this guy knew Oswald's story. He was talking about being in Russia. He was talking about his Russian wife. He was talking about his small child and had another one on the way. He knew Oswald's story, but Miss Cottrell said it was not Lee Harvey Oswald. I'd met with him numerous times. I knew for a fact it wasn't, but this guy wanted her to think that he was Lee Oswald for some reason. There's so many occasions like that. On Saturday, November 9th, just 4 weeks before the assassination, a gentleman comes into the Lincoln Mercury dealership in downtown Dallas wanting to test drive a car. Lee Oswald never drove, couldn't drive. And Marina said that, but that's on record too. But that's not the point here. This guy wanted to test drive a car. The manager of the car lot went with him, all right? And his name was Albert Bogart. And Albert Bogart actually wrote, and I've seen this, the business card. I've seen pictures of it. He actually wrote Lee Harvey Oswald on the back of his business card because that was a name he was given by this gentleman. And this gentleman, they test drive a car together, and he drives like a freaking maniac. And Mr. Bogart, you know, said he's driving, you know, down Stemmons Freeway, you know, 70 miles an hour, which no big deal nowadays, but back then it was. But, you know, but he told Mr. Bogart his name numerous times. This was not Lee Harvey Oswald. At the gun range, at the Sports Drome Rifle Range in Dallas, there were several times that a man passing himself off as Lee Harvey Oswald to people, telling them his name, was seen at the rifle range leading up to the assassination.
And there was also if I remember correctly, there was a phone conversation recorded between Hoover and President Johnson,
yes,
where they were talking about an impersonator,
yes,
in Mexico City, and someone who had approached the Russian consulate, or I'm not sure which consulate, but who was pretending to be Oswald. And Brad, if you look at the picture of this guy, it's striking. He looked like Mike Ditka. He didn't look anything like Oswald. He looked like he had a mustache and...
You know, you're right. I've always thought, who does that guy look like?
Ditka. And
the fact, yeah, you're exactly right. It did look like Ditka. The fact that they said that was Lee Harvey Oswald was really comical. That he was a heavier set, balding. You know,
well, that, Brad, you can listen to a conversation.
I don't want to besmirch Mike Ditka.
Yeah, that's,
you know, I don't want to pull him into this, but he would be a much better candidate for an assassination.
He could get down those stairs in 90 seconds.
Yeah.
But Brad, there's actually a conversation between Johnson and Hoover where Hoover is saying, look, we have these recordings of this guy who claimed to be Oswald in Mexico City. And it's clear, he's telling Johnson, he's like, it's clearly not him. It's clearly different than the guy we have in custody. This is before they killed, before Oswald was killed. But it's, and that's just the thing about this whole story is that, you know, we didn't even get into the Mexico City stuff or the autopsy stuff or the, I mean, it's just, there's so, and then, you know, it doesn't even take into account the whole story about how Oswald got to Russia and then got back here and how he was able to afford his lifestyle there and all the, and there are just so many stories. And, you know, you look back at the other assassinations in American presidential history, none of them, even Lincoln, none of them have these, all these threads. Even Lincoln, it's pretty clear who the conspirators were and even who they weren't, and they pretty much hung them all. And, and you know, this thing, it's just amazing how many different avenues there are to explore. And just when you think you've got the answers to one, there's another, and then there's another, and then there's another. And, you know, John, interesting question for me is, and I know we're running out of time, is do you think that these current disclosures that are coming out, and maybe more modern technology and the like, do you think there's any way we're going to actually find out what happened here?
I don't think so. Too much time has passed. You know, people were so excited about the records being released, which, by the way, Trump said that there would be no redactions. Well, there are redactions. There's a lot of redactions. All right. So everything's still not being told. Why? You know, Brad was in the FBI. I mean, why 62 years after the assassination are things still being hidden? It's ridiculous. We know all files on 9/11 have been released, but yet we still don't know everything there is to know about the Kennedy assassination that the government knew. But no, I think too much time has passed. Too many witnesses have died. Most witnesses have died. If you don't have them on record, you have no idea what they really said, which I'm glad I've got dozens and dozens on record. But there's no smoking gun in these files. I do not believe that the files are incredibly tedious to go through. There's no search engine on the National Archives website. There never has been. You know, you can't go on there and search Lee Harvey Oswald and all the files relating to Oswald comes up. I mean, and you have to match up the unredacted version with the redacted version and see, and it's such a tedious process. And I've been doing it, you know, every spare second I get. I do not believe, now there's some things that's come out. There's some stuff about James Angleton, who was the counterintelligence chief of the CIA, who clearly had a relationship with Oswald. There's something there with Angleton.
Amazing about that? That I found out, I was, I read Ben Bradley's biography a few years ago, and I caught the story about his ex-wife's sister, who was Mary Pinchot Meyer, who's the one, she's the one, Brad, that was killed on the in Rock Creek Park in DC. And there was a little story there about after she died in her diary. And I did, you know, at the time I just kind of blown through the book. Interesting story, but I was more focused on Watergate and some of the other stuff. And then you go back and you actually focus on it. And there's a story about how this woman who had an affair with JFK lived behind Ben Bradley's home in Georgetown. And Ben Bradley and his wife were very good friends of the Kennedys before and after he was elected president, spent a lot of time with them. But then after this woman is killed, this guy Angleton, who was high up in the CIA, is like behind their house trying to break into this guest house to find this diary. I mean, just, it's all so spiderwebby and connected. And then the story about how she was killed, you know, there was a guy that was charged with that, that was acquitted. He didn't do it. And so there's, you know, no one knows who killed her. And she was close to Kennedy and having this crazy affair with him while he was in the White House. So, you know, just an example of it. There's always something in this story.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I was encouraged for years to write a book and put down all my research in a book. And, you know, there's thousands and thousands of books out there on the assassination. And my book, I wanted to write the book for the everyday person that don't know a whole lot about the assassination, maybe, you know the official story. But I wanted to write something that the everyday Joe could pick up and learn some things about the assassination that our history books didn't tell us. And so that was my whole purpose of writing the book. And I don't go into, you know, rabbit holes about the medical evidence and all that, which, oh my gosh, there you could write numerous books just about that alone. But I try to touch on a little bit of everything in my book. And I've gotten so many positive comments and emails and about, you know, how the book has changed their life and how they didn't know this happened and that happened. And, you know, so many things, you know, it's like Operation Northwoods and things like that the American public don't know about that went on. You know, it's fascinating. So that was the purpose of me writing the book. I never, my wife one day said to me, "You think we'll ever be out of the red with the book?" And I'm like, "No." And that was
I just literally ordered a copy of your book while you were saying that. So I'm excited to get it.
My purpose was not to ever make money off the book. It was just to get, you know, a story out there to the everyday Joe that can pick it up, read about it and say, "Oh my gosh, I didn't know this happened." And it's all out there in black and white. I can't tell you how many hours I've spent at the Dallas Municipal Archives and at the police station and just going through. You know, there would be times I'd get kicked out of there just because, "Hey, we're closing, get out of here," you know, and just going through file after file after file. And so there's a lot of truth out there. It's buried. You got to dig for a lot of it. A lot of the truth out there that a lot of people say are just spewing from conspiracy nuts, it's out there in black and white. And like I said, it's just like a giant puzzle. And it's putting the puzzle together, and it's not easy. You got to do it in small sections and small portions to get the truth. Like I said, the grassy knoll shooter and just matching up witness statements. So, well, this matches this and this matches this, you know, and then after a while, it kind of paints a picture for you. You brought up Ralph Leon Yates, and I know we're running out of time before we go. That's one of the saddest stories. I mean, obviously the assassination of President Kennedy and how it changed the world. And I talk about that in the book a lot. Most people have no idea how the world changed that day. We didn't just lose one president. That day right there, we lost tens of thousands of Americans. Maybe not that day, but because Kennedy was killed, Vietnam happened. If Kennedy had lived, there would have been no Vietnam. And I tell people, you know, if you don't think the assassination affected your life, do you know anyone who was affected by Vietnam? Mm-hmm. Do you have a brother, an aunt, an uncle, a relative that was killed? Look how Vietnam changed us, changed our country. All right. That all happened because of November 22nd, 1963. Kennedy was clearly clearly going to pull us out of Vietnam. There's documented proof of that. Okay. But after he died, Johnson, the body wasn't even old yet. Johnson totally reversed Kennedy's policies on Vietnam, and we went full-fledged straight ahead. Now, the reason for that, I mean, a lot of Johnson's best friends were weapons manufacturers in and around Texas. A lot of them were going broke at the time. A lot of people don't know that. And they made a lot of money off of Vietnam. And so I'm not laying the assassination at Lyndon Johnson's feet. There is some stuff there to make you think that Johnson knew something was in the works. Whether you know, people believe the Madeline Brown story, which, you know, she claimed she was told the assassination was going to happen the night before and all that, which I'm not sure I buy that. I have met Miss Brown and talked to her on numerous occasions. But anyway, you know, the world changed that day. And stories like Ralph Leon Yates don't get talked about enough. This is a guy who was a refrigeration repairman who was just out doing his job, picked up this hitchhiker on Wednesday, November 20th, 2 days before the assassination, who he claims was Lee Harvey Oswald. this guy knows, you know, he starts talking to Yates about, you know, you think the president can be shot? You think it can be done from a high power building?
And he looked like Oswald. And he looked
just like Oswald.
It's crazy.
He dropped him off at the corner of Elm and Houston, where's exactly where the book depository is. And, you know, Yates goes back and he tells his coworkers about it. This is 2 days before the assassination. He tells his wife, Dorothy, which I got to interview her. You know what they do to him? They literally, the FBI puts this man in a mental institution for the rest of his life. He had five kids. This destroyed his whole life because he came forward and told his story. And look it up. But Ralph Leon Yates is one of the saddest stories that come out of the whole Kennedy assassination, other than the assassination itself.
Well, it's just crazy that a lot of this, I mean, these are folks he talked to before the assassination, right? If it was just his wife, it would be one thing. But there were coworkers, and it's just too many coincidences. And then for every, and it's obviously a tragedy what happened with him, but for every one of these Ralph Leon Yates stories, you have like Roger Craig, and you have Pritzker, and you have De Morenshield, and you have, it's just insane. But I, John, I know we are pretty much out of time. I want to thank you for coming on. Hopefully you can come on again and we can maybe focus on another part of this, because I think this is a very, very important discussion we're having, and everyone should really, exactly as you said, realize what was lost on that day and what happened. But I'd love you to talk for a minute about where people can get your book and your podcast, so that all our listeners can buy the book and subscribe to your podcast.
Yeah, my podcast, I'm recording actually today or later today, episode 111. So I'm up to 111 episodes. Like I wrote the book, I wanted people, ordinary people, to be able to learn some things about the assassination that our government and our history books didn't tell us. My book can be found on Amazon. You can get it also on my website. That's www.endofinnocencejfk.com. The site's down at the moment because I'm doing some maintenance on it. Or you can email me. I've been sending out signed copies of my book. You can get the hardcover for $60, the softcover for $40, and I'll mail it to you. So a signed autograph copy. But just email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com, and I'd be glad to get you one in the mail, and we can go from there. But enjoyed being on with you guys today, and call me anytime. I'd love to be back on with you anytime.
All right, thanks so much, John. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate you.
Well, buddy, there you have it. I mean, there was just not much to be said there. Every time Mr. Young opened his mouth, you know, new, at least for me, you know, new interesting things came out. I mean, this idea of there being two Oswalds, and
one of them being Mike Ditka,
who, again, I mean, if you're looking to get somebody killed and your choice is between hiring Lee Harvey Oswald or Mike Ditka, you're going Ditka every
Ditka
time.
All the
again,
way, yeah.
Not to besmirch Mr. Ditka. I'm sure he wouldn't want to be involved, but he's a finisher.
This is early 60s Mike Ditka. I mean, this is a different guy. This isn't the guy who's, is he alive? He's alive, right? Ditka?
Yeah. As far as I'm sure he is, in some capacity, you're not going to kill Mike Ditka. But
he was very
angry.
He had like seven heart attacks in the 80s, and he still coached a championship team.
Oh, well, that's what motivated him.
Yeah.
So, buddy, I mean, you know, it was good stuff. I'm looking forward to having Mr. Young back on, try to close the loop on some of these things. Why is there a 30-30 shell casing on some other building?
Well, you know what? I'll just say
maybe
this.
Maybe a pigeon dropped it. The pigeons left the book depository,
clearly
flew
taking
into the
evidence,
air, clamping a 30-aught or 30-30 shell casing and carry it to a different building, thereby screwing up the whole investigation. So.
I just real quick, my thing about that is I don't necessarily buy that there are people in these other buildings, because I think someone would have seen them, and I don't know. I haven't heard that anyone saw them, but and I also think, you know, Oswald most likely fired a shot, right? I mean, he was working in that building, and but you know, the question about, or somebody fired, it's tough to even say, right? Because no one saw Oswald coming down those stairs, and they're like, those women were on those stairs. So how do you figure that out? And if somebody else did it, how did he get out of the building? He or she. I just don't know. I've got to go lay down, Brett. I'm overwhelmed.
Well, you go lay down and get yourself ready, because we got to come back here and do this again in 1 week's time, which we will. we will. We'll do it. Mr. Young may be back, maybe not. Maybe it's back to our usual shenanigans. But in any case, we'll see you right back here next week on IP Frequently.
This has been IP Frequently. Once again, clearing a forest of lies with the machete of truth. You're welcome.